Sorry about that. Okay, so I'm presenting on the subversive uses of archival footage and oral sources, fictive histories of former Yugoslavia from 1941 to 1992. Before I start, I feel like I have to give you a cursory history of former Yugoslavia or of Yugoslavia. So I started with maps. And this is sort of the shaping of the Balkans. So I gave the years from 1914 to 1996 just to see sort of how the areas have shifted and which countries and regions it has included, and then why also, to explain also what kind of unrest or why the unrest has ensued in that region. So from 1918, there was the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. So once World War II started, and so this would be the next map, and the Nazis invaded the region, the different regions were occupied by the different Axis powers. And from 1945, from the end of World War II up until 1980, there was actually peace in the region because of Josip Broz Tito's rule. So he was the president from 1953 to 1980. After he died, the region ended up, there was war obviously, so this was from 1991 to 1995, and what ended up happening is that the six republics broke down. So we have Macedonia, so Macedonia was the first one to secede, then there was Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, then Montenegro, and most currently Kosovo in 2008. Okay, so so now for the essay. A popular saying during Josip Broz Tito's rule went as follows. Yugoslavia was six nations, five languages, four religions, and one Tito. The figure of Josip Broz Tito stood as a metonymy for the whole country, even though in the 1980s, Tito's, quote, real proclivities were apparent to most Yugoslavs. The leader's metal-encrusted uniforms, the army of flunkies that surrounded him, and the hermetically guarded palatial residences, not to mention the luxury yachts and the fleets of fancy cars, end quote. Despite these real proclivities, he's nostalgically revered as the man who delivered brotherhood and unity to former Yugoslavia in spite of its challenging multitudes. However, the storming undercurrents that ruptured the deceivingly harmonious surface in a series of conflicts in the 1990s point to the latent unrest which germinated during his rule. Purges of political dissidents, namely this is the Goli Otok, this is an island off the coast of Croatia where a lot of political dissidents were stored and eliminated, and numerous other actions taken on the part of the government to instill brotherhood and unity often go unmentioned within the popular contemporary discourse as Tito's time experiences a revival of commercial nostalgia. Erasure of these facts inevitably comes with time and corrupt intermittent governments which have succeeded Tito's rule and have thereby served to enhance the reverent nostalgia. However, nostalgia could also take a critical turn, whereby it assumes a reflective stance and discovers fissured spaces devoid of this metonymical figure, opening them up to reinterpretation and reconceptualization. The following presentation, then, will perform a comparative analysis of a film and a novel with a focus on their respective use of visual and verbal language to narrate restorative, reflective, nostalgic histories. I argue that these works accomplish this undertaking by combining fairy tale narratives with admixtures of archival footage, historical facts, and oral sources. With the confluence of fairy tales and history writing showing, they frustrate and reassess historical events that authenticate the nation of former Yugoslavia and confuse its imagined cohesive spatiality. So the first work that was selected is the film Underground, which was made in 1995 by Emir Kusturica, who is a renowned Balkan director, and he's been accredited with two Palme d'Ors, one of which was for Underground. The film came into being out of a theater play written by Dušan Kovačević entitled Spring in January, and that was composed in 1975. Dušan Kovačević, the author of the second work undergoing our analysis, Once Upon a Time There Was a Country, and that was published in 1998, collaborated with Kusturica on the screenplay for the film and went on to publish a novel from the surplus of material. Kovačević is a well-respected and well-regarded literary figure in the former Yugoslav region. Known for his politically subversive theatrical pieces as well as his screenplays, he is, quote, the most famous unknown playwright in the world, end quote. So the reason I selected these two works, it really started with the film, because Emir Kusturica received a lot of criticism for the work, saying that it was propaganda, because he used archival footage, and he used archival footage in a very specific way, and I'm going to talk about that later on. But he represents Slovenia and Croatia in a bad light, some would argue. However, what I found sort of problematic is that the novel, and this is also because there's a difference in the medium, the novel, because it does more of telling than showing, could also receive the same kind of criticism, except it hasn't. So what I've discovered while looking at these two works is that because they do focus on the history, they do use archival footage, they do so in a way that is very sensitive, and that they talk about the country of Yugoslavia in a very I suppose fragile way, as in it's very nostalgic, but it's almost this futural nostalgia, which I'll also talk about in a little bit. So they sort of try to restore a certain country, but then at the same time they recognize the fact that there was no country to begin with, that the country that was being held together was held by this one figure, by this one politician, and then once he died there was no way to sort of piece this together again, just because it was there under false pretenses. Okay. So the film and the novel, they're pretty similar. They're both set in Belgrade, and the film is divided into three different parts, and they're called World War II, Cold War, and then War. So the director decided to sort of give this kind of cyclical narrative of war, whereas the novel isn't separated into those kinds of components. It does speak about the different wars throughout, but it's not as overt. I'm not gonna delve into the synopsis way too much. What's very important to note is that this covers the area. It covers the years from 1941 to 1992, and there are a number of civilians that are actually underground, which means that they've been, once the Nazi occupation occurs, which is in 1941, a number of civilians are actually brought underground to remain safe. And what ends up happening is that one of the characters exploits their labor. He's a profiteer. He has them making guns and arms, and he sells them off, and he lies to them that World War II is still going on, and even though they're in the 1960s, World War II has ended, they still think that they're trying to actually get rid of the Nazis, even though they're gone. So this is why I think this is also a critique of Josip Broz Tito's era, because most of these people that are the characters in the film and the novel are actually underground, so they don't even know what's transpiring outside. Okay, so to do this, and this is where the interdisciplinarity comes in, I've used Svetlana Boym. My advisor has told me to read anything and everything I could find on former Yugoslavia, so that was quite interesting and overwhelming at the same time. But I ended up narrowing it down, even though I think it's quite extensive. So I decided to look at nostalgia and nostalgic histories and how the genre that both of these, the novel and the film, are a fairy tale, as well as a history, and what this combination actually is allowing for, and this is going to be the subversive use of archives. But so nostalgia means homesickness, quite literally, so it's longing for a home. And there are two tendencies or attitudes, as Svetlana Boym defines them, because she calls them attitudes just because they're quite fluid. So she says that focusing on home is sometimes hinges on nationalism. She doesn't say that it's completely negative, however, it can go into that area. And then there's a reflective nostalgia, which to me seems more like the postmodern attitude, where there's this kind of ironic stance, and there's this playfulness, and also questioning of attitudes and ethics, etc. So this is kind of the framework in which I view these two works. And then there's also, I looked at it in terms of history writing and how history, and this is Hayden White, mainly through Hayden White perspectives. So that history writing is quite similar to writing of literature, and that also writing of fairy tales. This is what I've compared, and I don't have the time to kind of go into it right now. But these are just the main aspects of what exactly the modernist techniques which is actually film in this case, and he's talking about the JFK, Oliver Stone's JFK in the second citation here, that so the modernist techniques of representation provide a possibility of defetishizing both events and the fantasy accounts of them, which deny the threat they pose in the very process of pretending to represent them realistically, and clear the way for the process of mourning, which alone can relieve the burden of history and make a more, if not totally realistic, perception of current problems possible. So even though some historians have found it problematic that there are certain renditions of history in film, this is also a way to sort of remove this kind of aura of having something be so factual, so clear, so true, because that's not the case. What we need is different kinds of perspectives and different kinds of subjects representing the same event. And then I've looked at fairy tales and as a genre, and also within this sort of political and social implications. And this is from Jack Zipes, mainly in that how fairy tales have been used, and that they've been used to propagate certain kind of patriarchal structures, and that to teach etiquette, etc. So they are very political. That all of these things that we tend to think, especially with fairy tales, if we think of them as something ageless, timeless, eternal, something that we've appreciated as children, how could that be political? And the case is that it very much is, just because of the way it emerged and of the way it became a genre. And then, of course, when we have Walt Disney, somebody who mass produces fairy tales and perpetuates certain ideas about sexuality and masculinity and or anything else, we need to stop and question why this is the case. Okay, and then finally, one more. There's archival theory. So I've also looked at archives to figure out, or archival theory to sort of figure out what exactly it means to have this kind of truth, what exactly it means to have a fact, and how do we get to the bottom of who's right and who's wrong, and who can preserve this kind of information, what kind of information is preserved. And obviously what happens here is that there are a lot of power relations that are the case in terms of selection, in terms of who has the monetary funds to preserve the certain things, in terms of their own interests, etc. So what I really liked here, though, is that Aseda Asman says that the institutions of the archive depends, therefore, on agents other than archivists to transform this virtual information. So that she calls upon artists as well as other individuals to actually reconstruct these archives and use them as means to be creative. So this is sort of in line with what Hayden White was saying in terms of the modernist event, as in that there's a possibility to sort of defetishize these kinds of facts. Okay, so this is the first set of footage, the archival footage, and what Kusturica does, he sort of tracks the Nazi occupation coming in. And they're coming in from Slovenia, then going to Croatia, and then going to Belgrade. And as you'll see, that what we have in Slovenia is that the people are Nazi supporters, and then in Zagreb as well. And then we have in Serbia, what's going on right now is that there's, in Belgrade, there's nobody there. It's just complete destruction. So this is where a lot of the contention comes from. Okay. So the first set of archival images which present the Nazi occupation identify the route the Nazis had taken to occupy what then was the Kingdom of Serbia. In this footage, we find Belgrade juxtaposed to other cities within the other factions of the kingdom. Therefore, the title served to indicate speciality. So there's a kind of connection between Maribor, Zagreb, and Belgrade, as in there, this is the kingdom of Serbia, Slovenia, and Croatia. However, this is just a connection, a root connection. In terms of their response to the Nazi invasion, they're not the same, as you can see. So it is not meant to, I don't think he meant to depict Serbs as these freedom fighters. He, the director, meant to show that there's this lack of a cohesive nation. There's no nation as a complete entity here. So why then does he use this archival footage? Does he do it to antagonize Slovenia and Croatia? So given the archival theory that I've sort of briefly brushed over, the filmmaker is questioning the legitimacy of these sources by framing them in a fairy tale. So we have to remember that this is coming into the fairy tale kind of genre. He's reflecting on the formation of national identities when reverting to original sources and whether they offer a site of unity. We must then look to the film as a whole and see its framing in order to grant it a kind of reading. Quote, as soon as there is a false entry of authenticity, with the help of true archival footage, the film loses its credibility and leaves the perimeters of a fairy tale. Kusturica edits in old archival shots, creates digitized i.e. new archival shots, and he does so to legitimately contest the truth of old images which have helped in constitutions of national identities. So he's proving that what we deem as authentic documentary newsreel footage is actually quite manipulative. And so this is this sort of, he uses fabrication, he uses film to actually show that, to show what kind of fabrication is going on within the footage itself. And this is what we see in his film, is that a number of times he actually shows the setup, we see how certain people are being lifted. So he leaves the props on stage or within the shot, so that we see that there's this kind of fabrication going on. So instead of issuing propaganda, Kusturica actually put into question what kind of country existed and what kind of unity has been held by props and illusions, making a parallel between artistic creation, historical composition, and creation of nations. So the next one, and this is really interesting, and this is where I was talking about Tito as this metonymy who held the country together, is that we have, again, Slovenia, Croatia, and Serbia, and then we have the same kind of, we actually have a unity here, in that people are responding to him in a very, they're all mourning him. So this is quite interesting because he uses the same music that he used when the Nazis invaded. He uses Lili Marleen. So he's sort of saying that it's almost the same as the Nazi government, that Josip Broz Tito and all the politicians he's brought to Yugoslavia, because Tito has established this human face of communism just because he was cooperating with the West and the East. He's sort of demolished this country in a sense, that they don't have a self-identity other than what they know from him. So, and it's also important to note that all the people that were underground, they've never experienced what exactly Josip Broz Tito did. So within the film, all of these characters that have remained there, they can't possibly have this sort of self-identity or identify with this nation, because they haven't experienced what it is, because this has all been lies. Okay, now for the novel. The novel uses oral stories, and let me just go really fast to that. So Kovacevic, he says, then something happened that would later be retold in whispers during the whole war. If that really happened, dear reader, or if the people made it up, we will never know. But according to the stories, this is how it happened. So again, there's this kind of questioning of who records the history, how exactly it happened, and he's referring here to the Nazi invasion and certain things that have been told about it. And then, this is how it all started. If dead witnesses could be trusted, with one tragic joke, and this is how it will end 4 years later, without any joke. Dear reader, verifying oral stories is a path full of obstacles. So once again, we have this problem with trying to uncover where exactly this truth is coming from, where these archives are coming from, and how they're being used. Okay, and the end of the novel and the film, just to speed it up, end with the following. Here we will build new houses with red roofs and chimneys occupied by storks and wide open fences for our dear guests. We will be grateful to this new country, which will remind us of the carpets of our old land. With sorrow, pain, and joy, we will speak about our country when we are telling these stories to our children, which will begin like fairy tales. Once upon a time, there was a country. And the ending of both the film and the novel is that there's this island that sort of breaks off, and it seems like some kind of future old time, but we're not sure. So the question just remains, what kind of country, what is the old country that he's referring to, that they're both referring to, because there never seemed to be a country? And which country are they talking about when they say once upon a time there was a country? Because the only point of reference that we have are these cities, and Belgrade in particular, just because this is where it was, where both plots were unraveling. So yeah.